Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
Gabon is about to experience a historic turning point because early results indicate a majority of the Central African state's 860,000 registered voters cast ballots in favor of a new constitution that could end military rule.
Gabon holds a constitutional referendum Saturday that seeks to end the transitional military government.
The position here is that they are being convicted without proving a crime. It's merely on suspicion.
An anti-graft agency seizes the property of Zambian lawmaker and daughter of former President Edgar Lungu.
Whoever the initial abductors were, the police were involved because the people were taken to police stations, and many times the torture happened within a police custody.
And Human Rights Watch accuses Kenyan security forces of abduction and torture. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Senegal is today voting in parliamentary elections, with the country's new president and his party aiming for a resounding majority to carry out their promises of reforms. President Bassirou Diomaye Faye secured victory in March, pledging economic transformation, social justice, and a fight against corruption. But an opposition-led parliament hampered the government's first month in power, leading Faye to dissolve the chamber in September and call snap elections as soon as the constitution allowed him to do so. Polls opened at 8 a.m. local time and closed at 6 p.m. with a timetable for results still to be announced. More than 7 million registered voters will have the chance to vote for candidates for the 165-seat assembly, choosing between 41 registered parties or other entities. We'll have updates on the results on voaafrica.com in the coming days. Illegal miners at a disused South African shaft are starving because police are limiting supplies in an attempt to force out the hundreds believed to be underground, a miner and a community leader said Sunday. The French news agency AFP reports one decomposed body was brought out last week from the shaft at Stilfontein, about 140 kilometers southwest of Johannesburg, and there are fears there may be more. Around a dozen people have resurfaced in the past week when authorities intermittently blocked local residents from lowering down food and water. A court on Saturday ordered that police must end all restrictions for helping miners at the abandoned shaft. While police agreed to end restrictions on helping the miners, they said those who emerged from the shaft still could face arrest for illegally operating in the mines. South Africa has long struggled to end illegal mining in abandoned mine shafts, saying it is not safe and often involved forced migrant labor. Gabon held a constitutional referendum Saturday that could end the transitional military government that ousted the Bongo family dynasty after nearly 60 years of rule. For VOA Moki, Edwin Kenzaka reports on the tense atmosphere in Gabon and the first results of the vote.
Ici, l'ambiance est plutôt calme, mais on sent tout de même une tension dans l'air. Ce référendum est une étape
cruciale. State TV reports Gabon is about to experience a historic turning point because early results indicate a majority of the Central African state's 860,000 registered voters cast ballots in favor of a new constitution that could end military rule. Official results are expected later. Officials say the adoption of the new constitution is one of the major promises made by General Brice Clote Oligui-Nguema after seizing power in what Gabon's military leaders call a bloodless August 30 coup that liberated the Central African state from political bondage. Nguema seized power from Ali Bongo, who was declared the winner of Gabon's August 26 elections with more than 64% of the vote. Gabon's military says the coup marked a spectacular end to the nearly 56-year Bongo dynasty, during which Omar Bongo Ondimba ruled Gabon for 42 years since 1967 and handed power to his son, Ali Bongo, in 2009. Gabon's military says it deployed troops Saturday to towns and villages and reinforced an ongoing dusk-to-dawn curfew from midnight to 5 a.m. to protect civilians and make sure there is peace and civilians are protected before, during, and after the voting. Serge Zang-Ango is executive secretary of the National Union, a political party that campaigned for Gabon citizens to vote in favor of a new constitution during the referendum. Ango says the new constitution will put an end to any chance of another political dynasty where succession was from father to son, as during the Bongo era.
Le Gabon est notre patrimoine à tous en tant que citoyens.
Ango says, unlike in the past, when power was confiscated by a few people, the new constitution is reassuring that ultimate power resides in civilians who can freely vote for their leaders and contribute to the development of their nation. He says those who voted in favor of Gabon's new constitution are happy that Article 42 of the law states that at the end of the term of office, the president, his or her spouse, and descendants cannot be candidates for succession. But opposition and civil society say the draft constitution should have prohibited military ruler General Nguema from running for president. They say military leaders prepared the constitution to grant excessive power to the president because they want Nguema to maintain his grip on power. Jean-Victor Mwenga Madinka is a former presidential aspirant and leader of the Movement for Social Emancipation of Gabon's Civilians, one of Gabon's political parties.
La constitution donne le pouvoir au chef.
He says by suppressing the post of prime minister, the fundamental law of 173 articles transforms Gabon into a country where the president has too much power. He says it is unfortunate that Gabon is increasing the presidential term limit from 5 to 7 years, renewable ones, when in America, a world democracy that the Central African state should emulate.
And that was a report by Moki Edwin Kenzeka. In Zambia, the lawyer for Member of Parliament Tasela Lungu alleges a raid carried out by the Drug Enforcement Commission appears to be aimed at intimidating and harassing the lawmaker. Lungu is the daughter of former President Edgar Chagwa Lungu. Attorney Charles Changanu also says Ms. Lungu has filed a court appeal over the seizure of her property. The appeals court is scheduled to hear her petition this week. His remarks follow a recent decision by the Economic and Financial Crimes Court, which ruled that Lungu failed to justify her source of income to enable her to purchase the 614-hectare farm valued at over $300,000. Charles Changanu tells me that actions by state institutions against relatives of the former president appear to be an attempt to intimidate and harass, which he says is disappointing.
In Zambia, we are guided by the Constitution, which has basic rights and the right to own property. Tasila Lungu, as a citizen, she is entitled by law to own property. Unfortunately enough, she has been taken to court in the civil forfeiture proceedings. And the civil forfeiture proceedings under the Forfeiture of Crime Act, the law is very, very clear. And the law protects her to that property.
But if there are suspicions that these properties were acquired due to the proceeds of crime, then the Drug Enforcement Commission, by law, is mandated to investigate whether the prosecutor's case is legitimate or not. So they are doing their job.
Unfortunately, that is not the position. The position here is that they are being convicted without proving a crime. It's merely on suspicion. And if that is the trend we are moving, then it is unfortunate many people will lose their property. They must bring evidence to that fact. You see, that's the problem we find in Zambia now, because most of the cases that have come before courts of law, they are perceived individuals, politically perceived individuals, where the state is taking over property, seizing over property without any criminal charge, merely on suspicion.
But there's a constitutional precedent where the court has ruled before that, you know, the state can pursue somebody whose income does not necessarily correlate to the properties he or she has acquired.
We can say it's personal because the people targeted are people mostly members of the family of the former president and those who were in the opposition. But the standard that is being set by our good court, it is conflicting. In a court of appeal, there is a standard set to say that you cannot take someone's property without proving a crime. And you don't look at the capacity of that person, but investigate to bring a crime first.
But isn't the Drug Enforcement Commission investigating these? So it cannot be said that these are politically motivated, targeting the former president.
Even if they are investigating, what is there is they must bring evidence to show that the property is reasonably suspected to be a proceed of a crime. And we have a court precedent in the Court of Appeal which has given a very good standard to say that do not take someone's property without proving a crime. Now, what is happening with the property for Tasira? Because your question was based on Tasira Lungu. You see, when a person's property has been forfeited, a court has made an order, the law still provides that that person has recourse to the law, meaning that that person can make an application to appeal over the judgment, to appeal over the forfeiture. And those channels are there in the law. Now, the instance which happened from where your question is coming, in anticipation of the Court of Appeal in the civil forfeiture of Tasira's property, the matter is still coming this week on 20th November 2024. But the state has decided whether by intimidation, Tasira Lungu, or in intimidation of the Court of Appeal, that they have no power or we have no power to fight the state. They went to Tasira Lungu's property yesterday by using a chopper, a government chopper, a public chopper, again intimidating us. So it is quite unfortunate that the state can ban fuel while the matter is still going in court.
Charles Shangano is the lawyer for Zambian parliamentarian Tasira Lungu. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Still in Zambia, the Secretary General of the Zambia Congress of Trade Unions, or ZCTU, says public workers will receive the equivalent of $18 as a salary increase beginning in January 2025. The increase follows recent negotiations with representatives of the government during meetings with 23 public sector unions. The announcement made by ZTCU Secretary General Joy Bean is generating debate and mixed reactions. Those who accept the salary increase say the government should be commended for showing a commitment to the well-being of workers despite the challenging economic conditions. But others say the increase is too small to enable workers to feed their families due to the sharp increase in prices of goods and services. For more information about the salary increment, I reach ZTCU Secretary General Joy Bean.
You are talking to someone who was on the bargaining table as the union team leader, Joyveni. We have managed to negotiate and being awarded a 500 kwacha across the board as a basic salary. Apart from that, what we managed to get in this year negotiations, Peter, is that we managed also to push government to almost double the transport allowance for our colleagues and members who are disabled. We also managed to have other increments in terms of repatriation allowance. Repatriation allowance was given to us in terms of an increment of 1,300.
Joy, the question a lot of people are asking is, are public sector workers, members of your organization or union, happy with what you were able to negotiate for them?
The issue is, when we went to negotiate, we looked at the cost of living currently. According to JCTR, that is Jesuit Center for Theological Reflection, a family of six needs about 10,670 to survive. But you discover that the lowest civil servant gets about 4,300, meaning even what we got is nothing. But I want to say that as members, I've got mixed feelings to accept and receive what we negotiated for. Others have also said a slice of bread is better than nothing, looking at the economic situation in the country. Are you aware that because of climate change, we have got energy crisis? We are being load shedded. So even some small businesses have closed up.
But climate change has been with us. It has been affecting almost everybody. Now, political parties use that to say the previous administration or former government failed to do A, B, C, D. Previous people did not have what it took to resolve it. We have what it takes to resolve. That is why people are asking that, you know, those reasons cannot be what is drawing things back, because they were promised better living conditions. So that is why they are saying, is that the best you could get them?
Peter, you are correct. But the Zambian politicians, they always come on scene to promise mountains, which they don't deliver. So it is true, they could have come during their manifesto presentation that we shall deliver this, we shall give you this, but the reality on the ground is different.
What assurances are you giving them that when things improve, they will get better raises?
Number one, as long as we remain united as workers' representatives, I'm talking about the unions. By the way, as we went for negotiations, we were 22 unions negotiating with one government. And that is also a weakest part on ourselves as labor movement. So the quicker we handle these issues of multiplicity of unions, so that we come together with a big voice, definitely we shall be able to get something from government. So going forward, we need also as unions to invest into research. What I'm talking about is we need also to understand fully the Zambian economy.
Joy Bean is the Secretary General of the Zambia Congress of Trade Unions, or ZCTU. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
From the emotional roller coaster of adjusting to their new role to coping with sleep deprivation and exhaustion, new mothers navigate numerous hurdles that can leave them feeling overwhelmed. On this week's edition of Our Voices, we will discuss significant changes in the postpartum period. We will also talk to experts about what can help shape a positive postnatal experience for women, babies, and families. Join the conversation Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on The Voice of America.
In Malawi, a civil society group says political parties are partly to blame for the low voter turnout in the ongoing voter registration drive across the country. It comes as the Malawi Electoral Commission compiles a voter list for next year's general election. The Institute for Policy Interaction, or IPI, says the nonpartisan of political groups in civic voter and education campaigns contributes to the low turnout at the polling centers. Praise Mwenengamba is the IPI project officer responsible for Malawi Elections Support Network project. He tells me that he has been engaging the political parties to step up efforts to help citizens to register to vote.
The political parties, I think they've forgotten their role of mobilizing their supporters to go for registration, for them to be eligible to vote come next year. It has been like a culture whereby civil society that have been already there mobilizing people to go for registration and also mobilize them to cast the vote during the voting period. However, currently with the low funding, CSOs are not on the ground to do such similar exercises they have been doing previously. That's where now we learned. I think the political parties somewhere, somehow, they have forgotten their role, or either they don't know that they have a role to play in this voter mobilization exercise. The reason being that during the political rallies, you find that politicians, they ferry people in trucks from point A to point B. But now comes this very critical moment of voter registration. You find that politicians are always shouldering the blame to CSO that they are not doing enough job on the ground to mobilize the people.
What are the other reasons why voter turnout appears to be low?
Fake promises that politicians make to people during this time, critical time of campaign period. Since the dawn of multi-party democracy, political parties have made lots of pledges to offering of creation of jobs and also, giving loans to people so that at least maybe they can improve their lives, but also even some other items like maybe the reduction in the farm and inputs subsidy, whereby all this today is just a mere story. So people are saying that we are tired with these people, that it has become a norm to them just lying to us. So whether we vote or we don't vote, it's just the same. So they don't see any reason why they should vote this time around to vote.
Since you engage these political parties, what has been their response about what they plan to do to, push up the numbers at the voting registration centers?
Yeah, this time around, on the 9th, when the second phase started, I engaged, of course, some other few political parties about their role in mobilization. And I'm glad to tell you that, of course, I've seen a few political parties with their vehicles also mobilizing voters to go and register with the MEC. However, the challenge that I've observed when this second phase of voter registration just started is that there were no registration bureau officers in each and every center, which is contrary to what the court ruled, that each and every center, there should be national registration bureau. So that means they should be accessible to those people who might be the new registrants. So for almost 4 days, so many new registrants were sent back home, almost maybe 200 plus people were sent back home almost each and every day, failing to access such kind of services to register with the NRB for them now to go and register with MEC. So these are some of the, maybe I can say it was a hiccup, but from the political parties now I've seen that there is a response. Even as I'm saying right now, in the field doing the same exercise, mobilization exercise. We have crisscrossed with some of the political parties, PS systems with their vehicles, also disseminating the similar message. So that means at least we can say that there is responsiveness on this angle.
Praise Mwenegamba is the IPI project officer responsible for Malawi Elections Support Network project. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. In Sierra Leone, a civil society group called the Campaign for Human Rights and Development International, or CHRDI, is calling on the government to urgently undertake judiciary reforms. The group points to what it says is a troubling culture of mistreatment, discrimination, abuse, and systematic failures, it also says, undermine justice in the West African country. In a response, representatives of the judiciary deny the allegations as unfounded. Abdul Fatoma is the chief executive of the Campaign for Human Rights and Development International. He tells me failing to carry out judicial reforms will result in a lack of trust in the administration of justice in Sierra Leone.
We made an urgent call to the government of Sierra Leone to actually look at the situations that is taking place at the judiciary and, you know, abuse of office and harassment and intimidations of court staffs where the court, the judiciary decided to send someone home for 6 months without a salary as a way of punishing him for not working within the confines of the workplace rules, according to the judiciary letter that we consulted. And we think that it will be necessary for the government to address this issue immediately, because we believe that including increasing independence of the judiciary, the constitutionalism of the judiciary, and also, you know, for the judiciary to continue to show that identity of separation of power.
Does your call necessitate the government to carry out an independent investigation into some of these issues that you've raised?
Yeah, and the clerk of the registrar that was transferred January, he has not been, according to our investigation, he has not been in his duty post since January. And the fact that he is a court administrator and he is also practicing, I mean, defending people before the same judicial institutions that he's working for, I mean, it raised a lot of conflicts of interest. That's a serious issue. And then he has not been working since January, they transfer him. He has not been working, but however, continue to collect salary while practicing law as well.
The issue of political interference in the judiciary has been raised as a major concern. Some people say it compromises judicial independence and weakens public confidence in Sierra Leone's legal institution, especially since it's the significant arm of the government. What is your take on that?
The judiciary seem as institutions that lack trust and lack confidence in Sierra Leone. Recently, after our general elections, a political party decided not to bring their political petitions, their election petitions, before the court. And several citizens hold such position. So citizens are not actually happy about that. And the makeup of our laws in this country clearly shows why the judiciary is not independent.
Do you think the judiciary can reclaim what some people say is lost glory?
Yeah, moving forward, the fact that we engage in a very genuine reform process, an inclusive process, then we'll definitely get back. We have missed it, and now if we are doing a reform, that reform should be inclusive, and that reform should be genuine enough for us to correct, you know, most of the mistakes and try to rewrite the wrongs. So with that, I believe citizens will start mobilizing confidence again into the judiciary and the individuals that are there, because we are talking about a judiciary that even operating on 2005 code of conduct. A lot has been done since 2005. It's almost 19 years old code of conduct. What happens, 16 years ago is not happening now. I mean, by then we are not having WhatsApp. We are not having TikTok.
Abdul Fatoma is the chief executive of the Campaign for Human Rights and Development International, CHRDI. He spoke with me from the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown. The executive director of the Human Rights Network for Uganda Journalists says the decision by the High Court to order compensation for assaulted journalists will have a significant impact on the country's political landscape. Robert Sempala also says security agencies sometimes appear uncomfortable when journalists cover political activities of the opposition or critics of the administration. This, he adds, often leads to the abuse and in some cases assaults of journalists. His remarks come after two journalists, Timothy Murungi and Henry Sekenjako from the state-run News Vision Media Group, were awarded $20,000 each after they were assaulted by soldiers from the National Army, the Uganda People's Defense Forces, or UPDF. For more reaction about the High Court's decision, I reach Robert Sempala.
This was least expected, given the might with which the military has been portraying itself. Because it wasn't the first time there was a beating of a Reuters journalist, Jimbe Akena, and this did not come to pass as we all anticipated, because there was overwhelming evidence, a video of the men in uniform descend on Akena. And so this time around, we were a bit skeptic about the ongoings, but we want to really commend the judiciary and the judge in particular for having come out so strongly to assert the irrelevancy of the practice of journalism in the country, even when the security doesn't feel comfortable seeing journalists cover certain sections of the news, especially those that relate to the opposition, the political opposition in Uganda.
Robert, do you think this could serve as a deterrent, or this will not have any impact at all?
The political environment keeps changing. I strongly believe that this will have a very deep impact on how the military approaches as civilians and journalists in particular in the line of duty. Because when this happened, there was a public apology from the Chief of Defense Forces. Then there was a call on the journalists not to go to courts of law. There were promises for compensations. But the fact, and that for me was a clear indication that the military felt that they had gone overboard. So now that the court has pronounced itself on the plight of journalists, will really be a deterrent. And we are likely to see the leadership of the military disowning some of the errant officers who will go overboard. Whether this will avoid a repeat at the climax of political campaigns like did in the, during the last elections is something that we are yet to see.
So 75 million Ugandan shillings, about $20,000, that's quite significant.
Yeah, certainly it is significant. It's not clear, however, if the government will be forthcoming in handing out this compensation to the journalists, but will make a humble appeal that if it's going to respect the court verdict, then it should go ahead and hand out the compensation to the journalists. It's such a good compensation given the ongoings in Uganda. And it's also a deterrent, but it would be prudent if the military would collect the said money from those officers that are implicated, so as this to be a huge deterrent than dipping their hands into the public coffers, you know, to pay for those that went overboard in the practice of their military duties.
Why is this commonplace that security officers often attack journalists doing their jobs?
It is not clear, very clear, because it's not anywhere documented why the military and the police, together with other security forces, may not allow the journalists to practice their trade, their profession. It could be attributed to the sheer failure to appreciate that the media plays a very central role in building a democracy, or it is because of the hypothesization of the military work in terms of approaching the political position in the country, or sometimes it is because of the disgruntlement that might catalyze some of the foot soldiers, the military that go to manage public order.
Robert Sampala is the executive director of the Human Rights Network for Ugandan Journalists. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Human Rights Watch has accused Kenyan security forces of abducting, torturing, and killing people believed to be leaders of anti-government protests that took place between June and August. The group says security officers held abductees in unlawful detention facilities, including in forests and abandoned buildings, and denied them access to their families and lawyers. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
38-year-old Mary Mudhoni Mwangi lost her son in the recent protest, where thousands of young Kenyans demonstrated against a bill that would have increased taxes. On June 25th, he took part in a protest where demonstrators stormed the parliament to show their displeasure with lawmakers for passing the bill. According to the mother, her son, 20-year-old Kennedy Njeru, was among those who entered the parliament. She says those who were with him did not see him again. She says, "I looked for him for 3 days, and on the fourth day, I found him in the city mortuary. He had a bullet wound to his head, and postmortem confirmed that." President William Ruto ultimately declined to sign the tax increases into a law, a victory for protesters. However, human rights groups say 61 people were killed across the country during weeks of protest. Human Rights Watch blames Kenyan security agencies for the abduction, torture and killing of people seen as leading or taking part in the demonstrations. Mausi Shegun is the head of the rights group's Africa division.
Whoever the initial abductors were, the police were involved because the people were taken to police stations, and many times the torture happened within a police custody, while the people were in police custody. And those who were dead, we don't have details of what happened to them, but those the people who witnessed their abduction said that the individuals who took them away were clearly security agents.
Researchers spoke to 75 people, including the victims, family members, journalists, parliament staff and police officers. The interviewees said that police officers in plain clothes, covering their faces and moving around in unmarked vehicles, hunted down protesters, making it difficult for the victims' family members, rights groups, lawyers or government agencies to trace their whereabouts. Shegun says some of those taken away were tortured and killed.
Now, many of the bodies of those who have been abducted have showed up, sometimes on the streets, sometimes in quarries, just in unmarked places where they've been dumped. And many of those bodies have shown signs of torture, dismemberment of body parts, showing what they went through in the hands of their captors. Now, many of these bodies have not been released to their family members.
Kenyan security forces have denied their officers were behind the abductions and killings. In late August, President Ruto, speaking at a town hall gathering in Kisumu, said he was not aware of any abductions and called on family members to forward their names to the government to take action. Human Rights Watch say reports of abduction, people missing and killings are well documented, and call on the president and other government institutions to hold those responsible to account. Mary Mwangi was among dozens of activists and victims' family members who tried to submit a list of the missing and dead to the president's office, However, they were driven back with tear gas. Now, Mwangi has retreated to her rural home in Kirinyaga in central Kenya, clinging to hope that one day her son will get justice. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from our African collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict and in time of peace. Here's Mama's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Currently, the voters of Senegal are going to the polls to decide what party or coalition will be able to form the majority in the legislature. In fact, this snap election was called by the winning party in Senegal to ensure that the party and its prime minister, the popular Mr. Sonko, can carry out legislations to fulfill the promises they made to the Senegalese when the party of Sonko won the election. The reason would be that the coalition, a powerful coalition for that matter in Senegal, are trying to make it difficult for the ruling party to fulfill its promises made to the people of Senegal. If they do succeed, Senegal will be faced with the issue of divided government. Divided government is always the preference of the corporate and elite interests in any country. And for them to do that, they must secure a majority in the legislature. And if they do succeed, they would force the president to appoint the prime minister of the choice. This is how divided government is made. In France, it is called cohabitation. Because of the importance of this issue, you could see that Prime Minister Sonko campaigned very seriously across the country to ensure that they succeed in gaining the majority of the legislature. The strategy is not something which is common. Africa does not see often the people denying the presidential winner legislature that will enable the party to fulfill their promises. But the opposition coalition is strong. It includes candidates like the mayor of Dakar that contested and lost for the presidential election. So we will have to see the outcome because it may have a serious impact in Senegal, particularly whether or not Prime Minister Sonko and his president will be able to carry out one of their major goals, which is to create conditions in Senegal that will deter young Senegalese to take the dangerous travel to find employment in Europe. It may be difficult, but there are those who believe that the government has a good chance of making a majority. But supporters of the coalition also believe they have a good chance of winning a majority of the legislature. So Africa will have to see whether we have now the possibility of a divided government in Africa, which is very rare, and how the presidential delegation or party will be able to react to such a situation. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect a flashback with music from the continent.
Sabi girl no dey too like talk. Animals dey in human form. Body man nobody like walk. But you must hustle if you want job. You no finish, they won't fight us. If them they run, them no fit catch up. I know they form say I too righteous. No con they form say you too like us. You no get the time for the hate and the bad energy. Come my mind on my money. Make you dance like Bokoli. Steady green.
they make my top in the rush. The kind money we touch. In the rush, in the rush, well, when it be much. Don't be hype, everybody they crush. There's no journey with us.
There's no darling.
increasing the commas. Come on, come on.
Was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington.
You don't finish me with love. Okay, your body fire go. Oh baby, why not go? Ade your matter. Your body not jam, hallelujah go.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are there on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters and engineer the great Bob Baz, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, when the lizard dwells too long along the river, it begins to think of itself as a crocodile. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
And I love that sweet jollof, and I didn't knock it for your door. Oh baby, make me perform.